Nuclear mass murder. As we mark the 79th anniversaries of the U.S. dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, it is not uncommon to wonder how, in the wake of such horrific and indiscriminate destruction of more than 200,000 lives from just two bombs, we were able to justify continuing to develop more, bigger, more devastating nuclear weapons of mass destruction. Did we not understand the hell those weapons unleashed on Earth? But then you talk with a journalist, someone who has repeatedly exposed what we don't know about the aftermath of the bombings and the PR spin that convinced the U.S. public that this was the greatest, most wonderful, and best technology since sliced bread. And he tells you,
it was important to cast the bomb in kind of a useful role and not something that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. And so what the Americans were exposed to in the many years afterwards was almost only scenes of rubble, scenes of landscape, pictures of the mushroom cloud, great destructions, surely, but not people.
Oh, yeah. That. Dead people. Well, when award-winning journalist and filmmaker Greg Mitchell goes over the many ways our awareness of what the bombs actually did to those Japanese human beings was suppressed, and how our government covered up the human aspect of that toll, and herded us into agreeing to a program of atomic expansionism that continues to this day, it begins to dawn on you on how we have all been manipulated into allowing, if not supporting, that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we acknowledge and commemorate the atomic incineration and radioactive contamination of more than 200,000 Japanese people on August 6 and August 9, 1945, 79 years ago. We'll have two features. In the first, we talk with filmmaker Greg Mitchell about his award-winning film, Atomic Cover-Up. It shows on-the-ground footage of Hiroshima and Nagasaki from as early as 1 day after the explosion. And when you see it, you'll understand why the U.S. government suppressed this footage for more than 25 years. But what was it like on the ground in Hiroshima after the bomb dropped? We hear the moving, powerful speech given by Hibakusha, a bomb survivor, Setsuko Thurlow, when she accepted the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. In it, she recounts her experience as a schoolchild in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, what happened when the bomb hit, and its aftermath. Hers is a deeply moving tribute to survival against all odds and a powerful call for peace. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than we paid attention to during the Olympics. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 6, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., following up on our breaking story from last week, uranium ore shipments from Pinyon Plain Mine through Navajo Nation in northern Arizona are on hold The mine is located less than 10 miles from the south rim of Grand Canyon National Park, and the transportation of uranium ore through parts of northern Arizona include Navajo Nation, as well as Hopi and Havasupai lands. Energy Fuels Resources, owners of the mine, began transporting ore without providing the legally required 2-week advance notice to Navajo Nation and the state. As we were recording last week, multiple tribal and state leaders called out the company for starting the hauling without notification. Late on Thursday, Navajo President Boo Nigrin's office says Governor Katie Hobbs persuaded Energy Fuels to halt the shipments to give both sides a chance to negotiate, and instructed the Arizona Division of Emergency Management and Assistance to partner with Navajo Nation to develop an emergency response plan in case a road incident occurs. Navajo Nation outlawed uranium transportation in 2012, but state and federal governments maintain jurisdiction over the highways. We will continue to cover this story. And to understand flooding problems posed by the Pinyon Plain Mine, we will have a link to an article, "Flooding at Uranium Mine Near Grand Canyon Tops 66 Million Gallons," that will be on our website under nuclearhotseat.com, episode number 685. In Ohio, which has been plagued by radioactive contamination by the dismantling of the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Piketon, among other nuclear problems, there has now been formed the Ohio Nuclear Development Authority, ONDA, O-N-D-A. It's been formed to push the development of what they are calling advanced nuclear reactors, meaning small modular nuclear reactors, the non-existent, untested technology, as well as commercial isotope production and nuclear waste management technologies. This new 9-member board, which is appointed by the governor, has been granted an initial funding of $750,000. The group was approved by the Ohio House in March of 2022 with the controversial goal of designing and constructing new nuclear power plants funded by taxpayers, raising concerns about political maneuvering and corporate influence. Critics argue that the board's mission to expand Ohio's nuclear capabilities prioritizes corporate profits over public safety and environmental health. Many citizens have expressed worries about the lack of transparency, fearing that the presence of industry insiders on the board will lead to biased decisions favoring nuclear energy interests over the welfare of the public and the environment. Southern Californians may be surprised to learn that, unless things radically change, they'll be paying for nuclear energy soon, despite the fact that the San Onofre nuclear power reactor has been closed for several years. But customers of Southern California Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric are expected to kick in monthly charges to extend the life of the aging Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant run by Pacific Gas and Electric in Northern California. While the amounts cited are small, between 87 cents and $1.25 or so per month, critics say those numbers grossly underestimate what folks would actually have to pay in future years. And if PG&E collects more money than it needs for Diablo, it could keep that money for projects in its area while Southern Californians would get, to use the technical term, squat. Keeping Diablo running through 2030, 5 years longer than its planned shutdown date, is an $8 billion to $12 billion endeavor. But does California actually need Diablo Canyon running? In the past 4 years, California has added enough energy to power some 14 million homes, and most of these new resources are genuinely green, battery storage, solar, or a combination of both. Public comments to the California Utilities Commission are being requested. And in Washington State, the federal government has chosen the Hanford nuclear site for a massive solar farm. Hanford is the most radiologically contaminated site in the United States, and the question then becomes, will the solar panels be able to withstand damage from radiation and function effectively for decades? As Japan acknowledges, commemorates, and mourns the loss of more than 200,000 people as a result of the atomic bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Hiroshima Mayor Matsui Kazumi delivered the annual peace declaration to the public, in which he said in part, "Last fiscal year, approximately 1.98 million people from around the world visited the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. This record number is evidence of unprecedented interest in the atomic bomb city and a rise in peace consciousness. My hope is that all world leaders will visit Hiroshima, experience the will of civil society, gain a deeper understanding of the atomic bombing, and hold in their hearts the Hibakusha, the atomic bomb survivors' plea. No one should ever suffer as we have. Then, while they are here, I hope they will, with iron resolve, issue a compelling call for the abolition of nuclear weapons." We'll link to the full peace declaration on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 685. And in Canada, the Hiroshima Nagasaki Day Coalition launched a Canada and the Atom Bomb photo exhibit inside Toronto City Hall. The more than 100 photographs document how the El Dorado Mining and Refining Company extracted uranium ore at Great Bear Lake in Northwest Territories and shipped the ore to its refinery in Port Hope, Ontario, for sale to the Americans. Since 2017, City Council reaffirmed Toronto as a nuclear weapons-free zone and called on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to have Canada ratify the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. We'll have this week's featured interviews in just a moment, but first, if the truth about the devastation caused by the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were better known in the immediate aftermath of those 1945 bombings, we might not be facing our current set of nuclear problems. Instead, the U.S. is building more plutonium pits to manufacture more and more lethal bombs. Russia and North Korea are saber-rattling their nuclear threats, and a new Cold War is on the horizon that threatens not just this country, but our entire planet. The truth of what those bombs did, especially visuals of the dead and dying, was suppressed, and the media around the bombings was manipulated for decades. It's still happening today. Without people viscerally understanding exactly how horrific these weapons are, what they do to the human body, and the threat they represent to all life on Earth, it's easy for those who make tons of money off nuclear weapons production to keep pushing for more, more powerful, more deadly products. And the government supports them. Our tax dollars at work. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat, to give you that all-important, different perspective on the nuclear world and what you can do about it. We're dedicated to giving you nuclear stories you can't find in mainstream media, providing them with context and continuity so you can understand exactly what we're up against and what you can do about it. But to continue producing, we need your help. This show runs on donations. And to continue to produce these weekly episodes, we need your help. We make it easy for you to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, follow the prompts, and help us with a donation of any amount. You can also set up a recurring donation for as little as $5 a month, same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. So if you value in-depth information on nuclear issues from that all-important different perspective, help us keep doing it. Please, right now, go to nuclearhotseat.com, donate, and know that I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's the first of this week's two features. Greg Mitchell is the award-winning filmmaker and author of a dozen books, including 2020's The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. His previous books on the atomic bombings were Hiroshima in America with Robert J. Lifton and Atomic Cover-Up. The focus of this interview is his film, Atomic Cover-Up, which combines long-suppressed archival footage with interviews recorded with cameramen who actually shot the footage. The film was released in April of 2021 and won the Best Archival Documentary Award from the International Uranium Film Festival, among many other awards. It's currently available to be seen for free online, and we'll let you know how to access it at the end. I spoke with Greg Mitchell on Saturday, May 15, 2021. Greg Mitchell, thanks so much for being with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start out with a little bit about you. What is your background and what has been your involvement with nuclear issues up to the point that you started working on this film?
I've been a journalist for the past, I guess you'd say, half century. I've been a magazine editor of national magazines here in the U.S., and I've written about a dozen books. I co-produced a movie not long ago about Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I was involved as chief consultant to a couple of major documentaries. So this is the first film I've actually written and directed myself. But my involvement with nuclear issues goes back, I mean, of course, I could say my entire life, since I grew up in the 50s and 60s. So I always was very much affected by the nuclear fears of that period. And then in the early 1980s, I became the editor of a magazine called Nuclear Times, which was the Bible of the anti-nuclear movement in the U.S. It had had an international influence as well. So from about 1982 to 1986, I was the editor of this important anti-nuclear magazine. And so that's when I really plunged deeply into nuclear issues. And as part of that, during that period, I earned a grant to go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki for over a month. So obviously I became really expert and interested in that, everything relating to the atomic bombings, even more than I was before. And I interviewed dozens of people, including the survivors and radiation experts and experts on the decision to drop the bomb. But relating to my current movie, the turning point was in 1982, I was exposed to and got to interview one of the two key figures in my movie, an American former Army officer who helped shoot this footage that was then suppressed for decades. I first met him, and when I became editor of Nuclear Times, the very first feature I assigned and published was on this gentleman and the suppression of the nuclear footage. I basically have written about it and been interested in it ever since. So that really goes back. I could say my film is 38 years in the making. I didn't work on it nonstop for 38 years, but I have been interested and continued to research and been involved with that subject for that long, really.
So you were aware of the footage. When did you first encounter it? When did you first start finding it? And what did it take for you to be able to do so?
The Japanese were the first to film in Hiroshima and Nagasaki immediately after the atomic bombings, shooting black and white newsreel footage. When the Americans arrived in September of 1945, shortly after the Americans seized all that footage, this black and white newsreel footage, and the American military began doing their own filming in color, which was very rare at the time, shooting in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So basically the two Army officers who kind of led that unit, who were the two key figures in my film, you know, created incredible color footage of the aftermath and the survivors, focusing a lot on the people, which most focus is very little on the survivors and the victims. It was on, rubble and destruction of the actual landscape. So not only did the Americans seize all the Japanese footage, but then this American, even though it was shot by the U.S. military, when they brought it back to the U.S., it was seized by the military. And it was suppressed for decades. So what the film shows is that the black and white Japanese footage did not emerge anywhere until about 1970, 25 years, and the American color footage even later, around 1980, when it became known that this footage existed. That's how long it was suppressed. So my film shows some of the footage for the first time. It shows the footage, both the black and white and the color footage, in 4K for the first time. So even if you've seen some of this footage, you haven't seen it this way before, the quality of the images. And like I said, a lot of it no one has really seen before. It hasn't been used in films to this date. And so it's a combination of actually showing some of this footage, but also the stories of the American, particularly a man named Herb Sussin, who tried for decades to get this footage released and talked to everyone from President Truman himself to top media figures to Robert F. Kennedy and others to try to get this footage released. And it actually only became known around 1980 by pure chance. And so that's why the film is called Atomic Cover-Up, because it explores this cover-up. Why, you know, why was it covered up? Why was it suppressed? Why is it important today? Why do we even care about this today?
In watching it, I've done a lot of research on my own about this particular era. But first of all, it was more footage than I've ever seen about Hiroshima and Nagasaki from on the ground. And secondly, it cast it in a completely different light because there was a personal human element to it. There were pictures of great devastation with one cart being drawn by a horse or a mule with a couple of people behind it. Apparently, everything they owned in the world was in there. And the juxtaposition, when we say bombing somebody back into the Stone Age, this was really starting to look like it. So it was very deeply impactful. Go into a little bit of detail as to why you think the footage was suppressed for so long, especially from the American public.
It's still a sensitive subject today. I mean, I wrote a book a few years ago with Robert J. Lifton called Hiroshima in America, which was all about the aftermath of the bombing and how Americans, both the media and public opinion, dealt with it ever since. We called Hiroshima America's raw nerve. It's something that America still has not faced to this date. It's something we perpetrated. Now, people could disagree on whether it was a good idea or a horrible idea or a war crime or whatever. But the fact is, Americans still have not really faced it, because it's this raw nerve. They don't really want to touch it. And this was particularly true after we dropped the bombs. You know, the war ended soon afterwards. It was kind of easy to kind of claim that it was the bomb that ended the war, even though it's not precisely true. And certainly we wanted the American public to feel that, you know, the bomb was, was a good thing, so that we could build more of them and begin testing them. And indeed, we then very quickly went ahead with our nuclear testing program, building more bombs, bigger bombs, eventually the hydrogen bomb. So it was important to cast the bomb in kind of a useful role and not something that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. And so what the Americans were exposed to in the many years afterwards was almost only scenes of rubble, scenes of landscape, pictures of the mushroom cloud, great destructions, surely, but not people. And what these films showed was focusing on the people, on the survivors, and what happened to them afterwards and how they suffered and what they looked like. So this is what radiation disease looks like. We didn't want anyone to know about or know much about radiation disease. So here's images of people who are suffering and dying from radiation disease. And I think in watching my film, without me beating it into the ground, probably 90% of the survivors and victims who are shown are women or children. They're civilians. You know, that's not cherry picking. So when you're going through, okay, I'm going to show this footage and this hospital scene and these patients, and they're almost inevitably women or children. And those were indeed 90% of the victims in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So without, I mean, I hope that kind of gets through to people, even if, you know, every 5 minutes, I'm not saying the victims were civilians. Just watching, you say, geez, there's one kid after another, and there's another kid, and there's a woman, and there's maybe an elderly man, and there's another kid, and there's another kid. Those were the victims. I think that's why this footage had to be suppressed for so long, because it was too focused on the human toll of the bombings.
What did it take for you to be able to garner this footage and be able to use it? Was there pushback? Was there a long process involved with it? Is there still resistance to it getting out?
About 1980, it was in the National Archives in the United States. And partly thanks to the article I originally published, filmmakers and the media became aware of it. It really hadn't been used until then. And so starting in, say, 1983, filmmakers and the media started using small bits of it. I always tell people, look, this footage is not now suppressed. I didn't do anything like I went in and dug it out or did a Freedom of Information Act. But the fact is that in this 40 years, very, very little of it has been used, partly because the media in the U.S. does not focus on this issue. They don't do very much with it. When they do documentaries or news coverage, they tend to use the same images over and over. And again, what's unusual about my film, which is unique, and believe me, perhaps like you, I've seen dozens and dozens of documentaries on this subject over the many years. And so there could be a feeling of how different could this film be. But this is the first film to look at this subject from the eyes of the filmmakers, of the documentarians, of the newsreel, people who shot the newsreels and the cameramen. The entire film is told in first person by the witnesses. And the witnesses are all the filmmakers. This is not the usual talking heads. Some expert comes on and explains, you know, what people saw or why it was important. Every single word in the film is from either the Japanese or the American cameramen or directors, and they talk about what they saw and then what happened to the footage afterwards. So it is completely different than any film ever on the subject.
I wanted to get to that narration because it was very compelling and it was seamless between the Japanese and the American voices. Now, you said that you had actually interviewed Lieutenant Daniel A. McGovern from the Army, who was the cameraman for the color footage in Nagasaki. Where did you locate the other voices that you end up having read in voice over? Were any of these people still alive when you started, or did you have to go to interviews and journal entries? Yeah. What was your sourcing of it?
McGovern, who was the head of the American project, I interviewed it again back in 1983, my 38-year saga here. I interviewed him and I got documents from him, formerly secret documents that he sent me. Herb Sassan, the other American leader, I interviewed him at length at that time. So their voices in the film, although they've passed away long ago, almost all of it is based on interviews I did with them myself. The Japanese newsreel people, everything is taken from oral histories that they did or autobiographies that they wrote, the interviews that they did. So everything is taken directly from their words that I had translated for the first time. No one has ever translated any of these things into English. So I had their words translated. And then the figure who I think is totally fascinating is, you might say, the in-between figure. It's a guy named Harry Mamura, who was a well-known Japanese cinematographer. In fact, he shot Akira Kurosawa's first feature. He then did work in Hollywood for studios. Then he went back to Japan. So when the war came, he was in Japan. But the American military knew about him. So when they went into Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they contacted the Toho studio and asked, could we use Harry Mamura to shoot a great deal of the American footage? So you have this very unusual and compelling, profound situation where you have a Japanese man shooting a great deal of this footage of Japanese victims for the Americans. And again, I had the relevant parts of his autobiography translated into English for the first time. So in the film, you hear Harry Mamura talking about in the first person what it was like to shoot this footage of his countrymen, badly injured, dying countrymen for the Americans, and how he felt quite different because he was a Japanese himself working for the Americans.
It's that humanizing voice that comes through that really very quietly underscores the tragedy of what we are seeing. And I appreciate the fact that you weren't coming in with an agenda. You weren't trying to make a point one way or another. You were just presenting the information and allowing us to invest ourselves in what you were showing and what we were hearing. And the combination I found devastating. I should never watch films like that right before I go to bed.
It's a nightmare, an international nightmare. It's still living with us today. So maybe that's a proper, maybe it should give us nightmares.
The film just debuted this year, and I believe this is the second showing of it in connection with the International Uranium Film Festival. What are your plans for it, or what is set up for it to go forward from this point?
It's been submitted to other festivals. It just was released last month. So it's really just beginning its path. We have a distributor in Europe who has made sales to the leading media outlet in Spain.
Great.
And leading media outlets in Northern Europe and the Baltics and part of Russia. And they're, again, they're hoping to place it, you know, all over the world. But again, it's very early on. So, and although I've always made a big point of the resistance of American media to this subject, certainly we have hopes that one of the streaming services in the US, whether it's Netflix or Amazon or public television or Hulu or whatever, will pick it up. And maybe for this coming August, you know, there's always a little more coverage. You know, last year was the 75th anniversary, and I had expected great deal of coverage. Actually, there was very little in the US, and the little that there was almost all very much pro-bombing. So it was the opposite of coming to grips and very disappointing. But every year in the anniversary, when the August 6th comes up, there always is a little more coverage. So we'll see if we get a major airing this year.
Here's hoping that you do. It's such a difficult subject matter that I really do hope that not only you, but all the films from the Uranium Film Festival get picked up as like a channel on Netflix so that people have the opportunity to see the range of right. what's out there.
Although this seems like a very familiar subject and people have seen images for a long time, what I seem to be getting from a lot of people who do see the film is that they're kind of amazed. I think it's put together in a kind of an artful way. People can watch it and feel that it's kind of a very artful presentation and not polemical, political, gory. They can come away, like you said, maybe a little bit shattered at the end and decide to look into this issue more or take some action.
One can only hope. Greg Mitchell, thank you so much for the film you made, for making it available to the International Uranium Film Festival, and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Greg Mitchell, director of the award-winning film Atomic Cover-Up. Atomic Cover-Up can still be viewed for free at pbs.org in its short version or in full through your library at Canopy, K-A-N-O-P-Y. I've been writing a play on media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. As part of my research, I dug into the question, what happened to the bodies after Hiroshima and Nagasaki? We say 200,000 people died. What happened to them? Because in almost all visuals we see, there's rubble and the skeletal remains of the building, with maybe a few people walking around, but no bodies. So what happened to the people who died? I found the answer in an article entitled, What Happened to the Bodies at Hiroshima and Nagasaki? It's disturbing, but it fills in an essential piece of the story. And I will have a link to that article up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 685. Now on to our second feature. Setsko Thurlow was a 13-year-old child in Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, in school when the United States dropped the atomic bomb on that city. As a hibakusha, an atomic bomb survivor, Setsko has worked tirelessly with the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. When the group received the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize for its work on the passage of the United Nations Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, Setsko, along with ICANN's then executive director Beatrice Finn, accepted the award on behalf of the group. Here is the deeply moving speech Setsko Thurlow gave on behalf of ICANN at the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo, Norway, on December 10, 2017.
I speak as a member of the family of hibakusha. Those of us who survived the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For more than seven decades, we have been working hard for the total abolition of nuclear weapons. We have stood in solidarity with those harmed by the production and testing of these horrific weapons around the world. People from places with long forgotten names, like Muroa, Eka, Semipalatinsk, Maralanga, Bikini. People whose lands and seas were poisoned with radiation, whose bodies were experimented upon, whose cultures were forever disrupted. We are not content to be victims. We refuse to wait for a fiery end or to slow poisoning of our world. We refuse to sit idly in terror as the so-called great powers took us past nuclear dusk and brought us recklessly close to nuclear midnight. We rose up. We shared our stories of survival. We said, nuclear weapons and humanities cannot coexist. Today, I want you to feel in this hall the presence of all those who perished in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I want you to feel above and around a great cloud of 250,000 souls. Each person had a name. Each person was loved by someone. Let us ensure that their deaths were not in vain. I was just 13 years old girl when the United States dropped the first atomic bomb on my city of Hiroshima. I remember that morning vividly. At 8:15, I saw a blinding bluish-white flash. I remember having the sensation of floating in the air. When I regained the consciousness in the total darkness and silence, I found myself pinned under the collapsed building. I knew I was faced with death. I began hearing faint voices of my classmates around me. Mother, help me. God, help me. Then all of a sudden, somebody shook my left shoulder from behind. The man saying, "Don't give up, keep pushing, keep kicking. You see the sun ray coming through that opening. Crawl toward it as quickly as possible." As I crawled out, the rubble was on fire. Most of my classmates in the same building were burnt to death alive. I saw all around me utter unrecognizable, unimaginable devastation. Procession of ghostly figures shuffled by. Grotesquely wounded people, they were bleeding, burned, blackened, and swollen. Parts of their bodies were missing. Flesh and skin hung from their bones. Some with their own eyeballs hanging in their hands. Some with their bellies burst open, their intestines hanging out. The foul stench of burnt human flesh filled the air. Thus, with one bomb, my beloved city was obliterated. Most of its residents were civilians who were incinerated, vaporized, carbonized, among them members of my own family and 351 schoolmates of mine. In the weeks, months, and years that followed, many thousand more would die, often in random and mysterious ways, from the delayed effects of radiation. Still to this day, radiation is killing survivors. Whenever I remember Hiroshima, the first image that comes to my mind is my four-year-old nephew, Eiji. His little body transformed into an unrecognizable melted chunk of flesh. He kept begging for water in a faint voice until his death released him from agony. To me, he came to represent all the innocent children of the world, threatened as they are at this very moment by nuclear weapons. Every second of every day, nuclear weapons endanger everyone we love and everything we hold dear. We must not tolerate this insanity any longer. Through our agony and the sheer struggle to survive and to rebuild our lives from the ashes, we Hibakusha became convinced that we must warn the world about these apocalyptic weapons. Time and again, we shared our testimonies. But still, some refused to see Hiroshima and Nagasaki atrocities as war crimes. They accepted propaganda that these were good bombs that had ended the war, just war. It was this myth that led the disastrous nuclear arms race, a race that continues to this day. 9 nations still threaten to incinerate entire cities, to destroy life on Earth, to make our beautiful world uninhabitable for our future generations. The development of nuclear weapons signifies not the country's elevation to greatness, but to its descent to the darkest depths of depravity. These weapons are not a necessary evil. They are the ultimate evil. On the 7th of July this year, I was overwhelmed with joy when a great majority of the world's nations voted to adopt the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Having witnessed humanity at its worst, I witnessed that day humanity at its best. We Hibakusha had been waiting for the ban for 72 years. Let this be the beginning of the end of nuclear weapons. All responsible leaders will listen to this, will sign this treaty, and history will judge harshly those who reject it. No longer shall their abstract theories mask the genocidal reality of their practices. No longer shall deterrence be viewed as anything but a deterrent to disarmament. No longer shall we live under the mushroom cloud of fear. To the officials of nuclear weapon nations and to their accomplices, under the so-called nuclear umbrella, I say this: listen to our testimony, heed our warning, and know that your actions are consequential. You are each an integral part of the system of violence that threaten humankind. Let us all be alert to the banality of evil. To every president and prime minister of every nation of the world, I beseech you, join this treaty forever eradicate the threat of nuclear annihilation. When I was a 13-year-old girl trapped in the smoldering rubble, I kept pushing, I kept moving toward the light. And I survived. Our light now is a banned treaty. To all in this hall and all listening around the world, I repeat those words that I heard in the ruins of Hiroshima. Don't give up. Keep pushing, keep moving, see the light, crawl toward it. Tonight, we march through the streets of Oslo with torches aflame. Let us follow each other out of the dark night of nuclear terror.
Hiroshima bomb survivor and dedicated campaigner against nuclear weapons, Setsko Thurlow. We will have a link to the full Nobel Peace Prize ceremony on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 685. As we remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we must also look to the present as the dehumanization of people not like us continues. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
It's 79 years since the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the first and only time nuclear weapons were used in war, but not the only time they've been used on human beings. And yet there are still so many questions, debates, and myths about why the US bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also about whether the US actually needed to drop the bombs at all. The yes, they did argument says that it ended the war and saved American lives. The no, they didn't argument is that the US needed to demonstrate the power of its bombs and it wanted to send a warning to Stalin, and that Japan was about to surrender anyway. That last one is a bit more complicated because actually we've now seen transcripts of discussions amongst Japanese generals after the bombing of Hiroshima, in which they argued and actually voted to continue fighting. After all, they'd seen worse casualties during the firebombing of Tokyo. That position changed once Stalin declared war on Japan. If, in fact, the US just wanted to prove a point about its atomic supremacy, what made it possible for such a callous and heinous act that was to slaughter so many civilians in such an agonizing way? One answer is that by then, the Japanese had been utterly dehumanized in the minds of the American public, depicting them in posters as buck-toothed rats and cockroaches. This made the argument of necessity, it ended the war and saved American military lives, all the more palatable. That dehumanization tactic was always there. It's what drove the new Americans to massacre Native Americans, it allowed for slavery, and it was rooted in Nazi Germany's elimination of Jews, gypsies, the disabled, and homosexuals. Similar tropes were used to dehumanize the Vietnamese people during the American war in their country. And today it is the turn of Palestinians, dehumanized and labeled as Amalek, the people who, according to the Old Testament, must be wiped from the face of the earth. If people don't look like us, then we lose our sense of humanity, decency, empathy, and compassion. That's disturbing. It's why on those two fateful days, the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were simply non-combatants who were sacrificed to demonstrate the imperial power of a country that didn't even have an emperor. After all, let's remember where the US got its uranium for the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. Most of it came from what is now known as the Democratic Republic of Congo, then the Belgian Congo. The minerals of Congo, where today a genocide has led to at least 6 million dead, the fighting mostly over mineral rights, are more important than the lives of the Congolese people. Early on, some of the Manhattan Project uranium also came from Dene land in northern Canada. Later, it was mined domestically on Native American territory. Again, we are looking mainly at communities of color and indigenous peoples. And of course, we just have to look at where the US tested its nuclear weapons, in the Marshall Islands. Remember that terrible Merrill Eisenberg quote? While it is true that these people do not live the way Westerners do, civilized people, it is nevertheless also true that these people are more like us than mice. That was a US government official speaking. And of course, the US also tested its nuclear weapons on Western Shoshone land in Nevada. So when we mourn the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki this week, we must remember what their sacrifice represents. A loss of humanity, a loss of empathy, a calculated dehumanization of people painted as other or worse, a willingness to see evil and innocence in the faces of children. That was true in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in Korea and Vietnam, Iraq and Afghanistan, and now in the Congo, in Sudan, and in Gaza. You don't need a genocidal weapon to carry out a genocide, but that willingness to do it, and the willingness of those who accept it and who even applaud it, makes all of our voices, those who call for peace, the most important voices that need to be heard in our present times. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Activists, shout out.
In addition to all of the national, regional, and local commemorations of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, the rest of the nuclear world goes on, and we need to address it. To that end, I'm going to be a guest on Harvey Wasserman's Solartopia program on Pacifica this Wednesday, August 7, from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. The topic, Diablo Canyon Nuclear Generating Station, what's wrong with it, the dangers we face from it, and the political manipulation that has led to its resurrection from the near dead. We'll have a link to the recording up on next week's show. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 6, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, it's the best way for you to guarantee that you never miss a single episode. You can, of course, sign up on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. The yellow box is right there. You can't miss it. And it asks you to opt in by putting in your first name and an email address. That way, you go on the database, and every week you'll get one email with a link to the program and a short description of that show's content. And I will get another boost in my Google rankings so that when people search for nuclear information, Nuclear Hot Seat pops up sooner. So help a girl out and put yourself in line to learn all the nuclear facts. Opt in at nuclearhotseat.com. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all, the support is always appreciated, and we thank you for caring. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you, the nuclear arsenal represents a self-destruct button for the human race. The words of Hibakusha Setsuko Thurlow. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Thanks for being there. Thanks for listening. And now, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.